Hello, and welcome to Administrative Remedies, because you can't fix what you don't understand. Brought to you in part by the University of Tulsa College of Law. I'm Gwendolyn Savitz, an associate professor here at TU and the Associate Dean of Research and Intellectual Life.
And I'm Mark Rourke. I'm the Dean of the College of Law.
We'll be breaking down complex doctrines with real-life analogies and examples to demystify the world of administrative law for everyone trying to understand how government actually works.
Agencies are the main way the federal government gets things done. It's not through Congress, for reasons we'll be addressing over the course of this series.
Last time we talked about Skidmore, the doctrine that says agency interpretations deserve respect only to the extent they're persuasive. Today, we're talking about the case that left nothing else standing, Loeb or Bright, the Supreme Court decision that overturned Chevron.
After 40 years, overturned Chevron.
Yes, after 40 years. But before we dig into why critics think this decision was wrong, we needed to give the other side a fair hearing, because there was a real problem Loeb or Bright was trying to solve.
So let's go back to the babysitter.
We can do that. You need somebody last minute. You've decided to use a babysitting service. So you leave the same instructions that you regularly do. Keep the kids safe when they play outside.
Reasonable expectation.
That is certainly a minimum standard for a babysitter. Monday's babysitter, we're going to call her Soraya Stringent, interprets this very carefully. If the kids are on scooters, they need to be wearing helmets. They can't leave the yard. There's no climbing trees. She's reapplying sunscreen every hour.
Reasonable expectation. A court under Chevron would defer to those choices.
It would. And so then Wednesday comes, and this time you have a different babysitter from the service. This is Lindsay Laissez-Faire. Same instructions, keep the kids safe when they play outside. But Lindsay is interpreting this a bit differently. The kids don't need helmets if they're on scooters. They can walk to the park that's three blocks away. It's fine if they climb trees. That'll build confidence.
Also reasonable. I mean, kids did this stuff in the 90s, and we mostly survived.
We did. So both interpretations are defensible. Both babysitters can point to legitimate safety philosophies. And under Chevron, courts would defer to either one.
So what's then the problem?
Friday comes, and now Soraya's back. The kids have to have helmets again. There's no park. They can't climb trees. The rules have changed again, even though the parents' instructions never changed. So the kids are not happy.
Okay, and this is the case for Loeb or Bright, right? Stability, predictability.
Yes, it is a real problem, and it's a fair criticism of how Chevron worked in practice.
But
today, we're going to explain why critics think the cure is worse than the disease, why replacing agency expertise with judicial interpretation creates even bigger problems, because the flip-flopping babysitters aren't the only characters in the story.
There's also the overconfident grandparents.
There are grandparents who show up, see helmets and sunscreen, and absolutely lose it. In my day, we didn't need any of this. The problem with kids today is you coddle them too much. And they override the babysitter, who's been there all day watching the kids, making reasonable judgments, because they think they know the single correct meaning of be careful.
Courts basically replacing the babysitter.
Yes, that's Loeb or Bright. But first, let's talk about what actually happened in the case. So Loeb or Bright Enterprises is a herring fishing company. They operate in federal waters off the Atlantic coast, more like New Jersey area.
Herring fishing, not very many constitutional cases that come out of herring fishing.
Yeah, that's how a lot of these cases seem to work. There's pretty mundane facts, and from that we get massive doctrinal shifts. So for this case, under the Magnuson-Stevens Act, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has the authority to implement fishery management plans. One requirement is that certain boats have to carry federal observers.
Observers? You mean like people who watch them fish?
Yes. These people are monitoring catch levels, they're ensuring compliance with the regulations, and Congress has specifically authorized these observers, but what Congress didn't clearly say was who pays for them.
I see where this is going.
So in 2020, NOAA issued a rule requiring the industry to pay for the observers. This is about $700 a day. And for a small fishing operation, that was about 20% of their revenue.
That seems like a pretty significant financial burden.
Which is why these were such great plaintiffs. The fishing companies argued Congress never said we had to pay for this. And under Chevron, if Congress hasn't clearly spoken to an issue and the agency's interpretation is reasonable, the agency would likely win. NOAA could point to the general authority to implement fishery management plans and say requiring industry funding is a reasonable way to implement that.
But the court didn't apply Chevron.
It did not. The court overruled Chevron entirely. Roberts wrote the majority opinion. Do you want to read the key holding here?
Yeah. So Roberts said, Chevron is overruled. Courts must exercise their independent judgment in deciding whether an agency has acted within its statutory authority as the Administrative Procedures Act requires. Careful attention to the judgment of the executive branch may help inform that inquiry. And when a particular statute delegates authority to an agency consistent with constitutional limits, courts must respect the delegation while ensuring that the agency acts within it. But courts need not, and under the Administrative Procedures Act, may not defer to an agency interpretation of the law simply because a statute is ambiguous.
So the key phrase here is independent judgment. Courts will no longer defer to any reasonable agency interpretation. Courts decide for themselves what the statute means.
What was the court's reasoning here?
There's a few things that Roberts was thinking about. First, he mentions the APA, the Administrative Procedure Act from 1946. That's the rule that requires courts to decide all relevant questions of law. Here's what he had to say about that.
The Administrative Procedures Act specifies that courts, not agencies, will decide all relevant questions of law arising on review of agency action, even those involving ambiguous laws.
The APA part that he's quoting is the part that says all relevant questions of law. It definitely does not say even those involving ambiguous laws. But second, he argued that Chevron conflicted with the Constitution. So courts interpret laws. That's what Article 3 says they do. Deferring to agencies on any question of law means that courts are abdicating their constitutional role.
But wait, didn't we talk about how courts have been deferring to agencies since before Chevron? And really, since before the Administrative Procedures Act?
Yes, we did. We talked about cases going back decades before the APA, where courts gave way to agency interpretations. And that's one of the major criticisms of Loper-Bright, that it rewrites history. But we'll get to that.
Okay, so what about the fishing companies? Did they win?
This is one of those cases where the facts matter so little that it doesn't even matter how it came out. The case was just remanded for the lower court to apply the new standard. So the impact here won't be on the herring fishing industry. It's about every agency interpretation of every ambiguous statute across the entire federal government.
Is this one of those cases where the stakes are so small because the arguments are so big?
Yeah. That's a good way to describe it.
Okay. So let's dig into the criticisms.
So we're going to organize this around three big themes. First, the court rewrote history. We talked about that a little. Second, that the court misunderstands how modern governance works. And third, that the practical consequences are already causing chaos. So, first part of this, how the court rewrote history. Loper-Bright describes Chevron as some kind of bizarre 1980s deviation from what the court had always done. The majority says the APA requires courts to decide questions of law independently, and Chevron violated that.
But we covered this in the Chevron episode. Courts were deferring to agencies long before 1984.
Yes, exactly. This was like United States v. Hammers from 1911, where the court said agency interpretations were in the highest degree persuasive, if not controlling. Or Ford Motor Credit from 1980, just 4 years before Chevron, where the court said deference to the Federal Reserve was compelled by necessity.
And Yakis in 1944, right before the APA was passed.
Yes, in Yakis, the court said, and we also quoted this in the earlier episode, that the Constitution has never been regarded as denying to the Congress the necessary resources of flexibility and practicality to perform its function. The court was extremely deferential to agencies that had been given rulemaking authority.
So Chevron wasn't inventing anything new.
It absolutely was not. It was formalizing what courts had been doing for decades. The two-step test really just made crystal clear and predictable what the courts were already doing. That underlying principle that agencies with expertise and delegated authority deserve respect when interpreting ambiguous statutes. I realize that we're getting to kind of a broken record here, but here's a case excerpt from United States v. Moore. It's from 77, and it, again, talks about the kind of deference that predated Chevron.
So in that case, the court said the construction given to a statute by those charged with the duty of executing it is always entitled to the most respectful consideration and ought not be overruled without cogent reasons, though officers concerned are usually able men and masters of the subject.
All right. That dated language makes more sense when I tell you that this is an 1877 opinion. So to repeat, courts were giving deference to agency interpretations of the statutes they were executing because they were experts in that area in 1877. The talk that says Chevron changed everything is like someone saying, in my day, we didn't defer to agencies, except that you actually did all the time.
Okay, so what's the second criticism?
So the second issue is that the court fundamentally misunderstands how modern government works. Congress has to write statutes with flexible terms, reasonable, feasible, appropriate, adequate.
We talked about this in the delegation episode, where Congress can't possibly specify every single thing. That's why courts require an intelligible principle, but not a detailed set of instructions to mindlessly put in place.
Right. And that's not a flaw. That's a feature of the process. The world is way too complex and changing too fast for Congress to anticipate every possible application of every statute. So Congress delegates. And agencies use scientists, engineers, economists, medical experts, risk analysis, real-world data to try and figure out what these things should mean in specific contexts. Judges are smart, but they're generalists. They could see a fishery case, tax case, environmental case, labor case all in the same week. They don't have the deep expertise that comes from working on these issues every single day for years.
And so Loper Bright acknowledges this, right? I mean, Robert says the courts can still consider agency expertise.
He says that careful attention to the judgment of the executive branch may help inform the court's inquiry, but may help inform is very different from defer to reasonable interpretations. Under Chevron, if the agency did the work and reached a reasonable conclusion, that was enough. Under Loper Bright, the court will decide independently for itself what the statute means, and the agency's views are just one input among many.
What's actually then happening in the courts?
Chaos. Let's talk about a few different areas of law.
This is where those flip-flop examples come in.
Yeah, partly. So remember that the argument for Loper Bright was that Chevron enabled flip-flopping. Agencies were changing interpretations each time a new presidential administration came in. As the parties changed, the interpretations changed. Net neutrality was a telecommunications service, then an information service, then a telecommunications service again. The joint employer test kept changing. The definition of waters of the United States under the Clean Water Act first covered temporary streams, then it didn't, then it did again.
So generally a destabilizing set of circumstances.
Yes, it was. But what Loper Bright's critics are pointing out now is that instead of agency flip-flops in response to political changes, we have judicial fragmentation. Different circuits govern different parts of the country, and different circuits are reaching different conclusions about what statutes mean. And unlike agency interpretations, which at least apply to the entire country, these can be fragmented across the country at the same time.
So instead, the rules changing every 4 to 8 years with new administrations?
They change depending on what circuit you're in. A company operating in the Fifth Circuit might face different legal requirements from a company in the Ninth Circuit, even though they're subject to the same federal statute, because Loper Bright gave the courts an excuse to totally disregard what the agency was doing.
That seems much worse, not better.
I would say, here's what the Second Circuit said about deference, just months after Loper Bright.
Deference is now a relic of the past.
A relic of the past. In that case, they were interpreting the definition of particularly serious crime for deportation purposes. These are life-altering determinations, whether someone gets to stay in the country, and courts are now saying that they'll decide what the statutory terms mean with no deference to the agency that handles thousands of these cases.
What about the other areas?
In labor law, the Fifth Circuit struck down the Department of Labor's tipped wage rule. This was the 80-20 rule about how much time tipped employers could spend on non-tipped duties, and they did this explicitly using Loper Bright. We can see this in environmental area, in energy regulations. The Sixth Circuit just struck down the FCC's net neutrality rules.
The flip-flopping hasn't stopped.
It's really just gotten more chaotic. At least under Chevron, we were likely to have a national interpretation. Now, different circuits are arriving at the one true meaning of the statute and coming out in different places.
And here's what I keep thinking about. Judges don't just interpret statutes in the abstract. They're deciding real cases with real consequences.
Yes. And when a court strikes down an EPA rule on particulate matter, that affects the air quality for millions of people. If a court reinterprets OSHA's authority over workplace safety, that affects whether workers are protected from hazards. These aren't academic exercises.
So let's make this concrete. How does Loper Bright affect ordinary people's lives?
Here's an example that could be a little more relatable. We've talked about how the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act requires food labels to be truthful and not misleading. Congress said that the FDA is authorized to regulate health claims. These are statements that describe the relationship between a food substance and disease risk.
Like, may reduce the risk of heart disease.
Yes, or supports a healthy immune system, or even low fat. But here's the problem. Congress never defined what makes a claim false or misleading in this context. What level of scientific evidence do we need before a company can claim that their cereal reduces heart disease? Can you call something low fat if it has 3 grams of fat per serving? 2 grams? 5?
So those seem like questions that need specific answers.
They do. And FDA had been providing those answers for decades. They've developed detailed rules about what scientific evidence you need for different types of health claims. They've defined exactly what low fat and reduced sodium and good source of fiber mean. Under Chevron, courts would defer to FDA's interpretation of misleading when the agency required, say, significant scientific agreement before a company could make a disease risk claim.
And now?
All right. Well, imagine we've got a company that wants their product to, say, prevents dementia. The FDA says, no, there's no science actually backing that up. That claim is misleading. But the company sues, and under Loper-Bright, the court has no need to defer to FDA's scientific judgment about what could make a health claim misleading. The court would decide independently what Congress meant by false or misleading.
So a federal judge with no background in clinical research or nutrition science is now deciding what level of evidence makes a health claim misleading versus truthful.
Yes. A judge in the Fifth Circuit might think misleading only covers outright lies. If there's any study supporting a claim, it's not misleading. A judge in the Ninth Circuit might think misleading includes claims that cherry-pick weak evidence. Suddenly, the legal standard for food labeling depends on where you live.
So a company whose prevents cancer claim gets rejected in California could try again in Texas.
They could, and they could be legally selling the product in Texas and not in California under whatever the relevant regulation was that theoretically applies uniformly across the country. So this means that forum shopping is a real strategy. And the flip-flopping babysitter problem was real. FDA has changed its position on various labeling questions over the years. But again, when they did that, they were doing it on a national basis. Everyone selling food followed the same FDA interpretation of what misleading means. Now we can have a dozen different circuit court interpretations, each claiming to be the one true correct reading of what Congress meant.
Loper-Bright said each statute has one single best meaning.
Yes, it did. And that's going to be true in practice if only one court ever interprets it. When you have hundreds of judges in a dozen circuits, each exercising independent judgment, you're going to get different answers. And unlike when agencies flip-flop, there's no mechanism for quick correction. It takes years to get circuit splits resolved by the Supreme Court if they even ever take it.
Meanwhile, consumers don't know which health claims to trust.
And companies don't know what they're allowed to say. The whole point of having FDA interpret these terms was predictability and expertise. Now we're trading agency flip-flopping for judicial fragmentation.
So now my cereal box is going to say prevents heart disease, maybe.
It could say prevents heart disease here in Oklahoma and something totally different if you cross the line into Kansas.
Are there other areas like this?
Same thing for drug approvals in the FDA. What does safe and effective mean for a new medication? This is going to apply in workplace safety. What counts as a recognized hazard? Environmental protection. What's the best available technology for controlling pollution? We could go on and on.
And all of that is now subject to independent judicial interpretation.
Yes, with courts that have a fraction of the agency's expertise and resources.
There's another dimension to this, isn't there? What about who makes policy in a democracy?
Yes, this is something that Justice Kagan emphasized in her dissent. When an agency interpreted an ambiguous statute, that interpretation was connected to the president. The president appointed the agency heads. If you didn't like the EPA's interpretation, elect a new president. Those kinds of changes were why we had those problematic flip-flops.
So agency interpretations were accountable to the voters in a sense.
Yes, they were, at least to some extent. In contrast, judges have life tenure. They are not accountable to anyone. When a court decides what waters of the United States means, the only recourse would be for Congress to pass a new, clearer statute.
And we know how hard it is for Congress to pass anything.
Yes, they're absolutely gridlocked. They can barely pass a budget, let alone detailed technical legislation specifying what every statutory term means. By eliminating Chevron, the court shifted enormous power from the elected branches to the judiciary.
It seems rather ironic, actually. The court said Chevron gave too much power to agencies, unelected bureaucrats making the law, but now judges are also unelected, are making these decisions.
Yes. The difference was that the agency head at least served at the pleasure of the president, who was elected, and judges serve for life. So this makes it significantly less democratically accountable.
So the grandparents who never have to face the voters.
Yes, and who can override the babysitter whenever they want, even though the babysitter is the one who's actually accountable to the parents.
Okay, so Chevron is gone. After 40 years, courts no longer defer to agency interpretations, which is a massive shift on its own.
It is. But here's the thing. Loper-Bright isn't the only major administrative law decision from that term. And next episode, we're going to talk about a case that might be even more destabilizing.
Even more destabilizing than killing Chevron.
At the time, it seemed almost inconceivable, which now seems quaint. But this is Corner Post Reboard of Governors. It's about the statute of limitations and when you can challenge a regulation. In this case, the Supreme Court said the clock doesn't start until you are personally injured by the rule, which means regulations that have been on the books for decades are open to challenge by anyone who wasn't around when they were issued.
So Loper-Bright says courts don't defer to agencies, and Corner Post says you can challenge regulations forever.
Yes, now you can see why I'm saying this is probably even more destabilizing. By adding these two together, you're really multiplying the problems. Every old regulation is vulnerable to a fresh challenge, and when those challenges occur, they're going to be decided by judges who no longer defer to the agency that wrote the regulation.
That sounds like chaos on top of chaos.
It does. One of the dissenting judges said we're going to be entering a regulatory Wild West. Next time, we'll dig into exactly how that works and what it means.
And that's our season finale.
Yes, it will be. Corner Post is going to be the last episode of season one. We'll wrap up by looking at where administrative law stands after this term, with Chevron gone, time limits gone, and what that's going to mean for the regulatory state going forward.
I'm looking forward to learning more about Corner Post. Until then, I'm Mark Rourke.
And I'm Brent Savitz. We will see you next time for the season finale.
So that does it for today's episode on administrative remedies. Thank you for joining us today. Please, if you enjoy this podcast and enjoy this episode, give us a like on Spotify, iTunes, or whatever platform you're listening on. And be sure to tune in next time where we'll continue to dive into the contours of administrative law, because remember, you can't fix what you don't understand.